Good morning, everybody. You're all on mute, except for me. And in a moment, we'll have Nancy Stock joining us, and she'll also be on unmute. Let me tell you a little bit about what's happening today. And I have to pull up a document, so I'm going to look at that. All right. Good morning. This is what we hope will be the first of a long series of quarterly calls, Zoom meetings. There are some preliminaries. The format for today is that Judge Nancy Stock will take the lead in introducing topics. You will all be on mute. If you have questions, you can either text or email me. And my phone number, the place to text, is 503-949-7935. That's probably the best way. The second best way is to send a note in the chat function of Zoom if you're on Zoom. And the third best way is email me at rbirke@jamsadr.com. And I'm going to do my best to filter those questions into the conversation. Once Judge Stock has said what she has to say about a topic, we'll open the mics, that is, unmute you all, and have a group discussion to your heart's content or until we run out of time, whichever comes first. And if we exhaust the topic with time to spare, we'll start another topic, wash, rinse, repeat. Because we're all friends here, I'd like to keep it informal, and I have Judge Stock's permission to not say Judge Stock anymore. I'm going to call her Nancy, and we're all going to try to keep this on a first name basis. Second thing to know, that's the format for today. We're going to see how this works. This entire program exists for your benefit, and if you experience today's format and have thoughts about how we could augment it or improve it, please pass them along to me and we'll make it work. You can consider this like a wiki. We'll just keep changing it as we need to. And also, like super cool people, we're going to be engaged in what's called design thinking, very trendy. What that means essentially for our purposes, prototype it, break it, prototype it again. So we hope that this format is one that's satisfactory to you, but we're not cemented. Third, we'll need a date to pick for the next one sometime in the second quarter. And my thinking is that we would rotate the role that Nancy is playing today. See, I slipped straight into that informal thing so smoothly. And the idea is that the leader of each session gets to choose what topics we discuss. Now, fourth, because Nancy and Sheila Sonnenschein were among the most prime of the prime movers for this effort, Sheila will be the host of the second meeting next quarter. We'll be looking for people to host subsequent calls. So if you have an interest in hosting, which allows you to choose topics, please let me know. And I'm happy to work with you to be, you know, the Ed McMahon to your Johnny Carson, or, you know, choose whatever analogy you want. Finally, because some of our colleagues are unavailable today, I'm using the Zoom record feature for this call. I know that recording has the potential to stifle open discussion, and I hope that won't be the case here. Let me tell you a couple of things to think about. One is the recording will be kept on the JAMS Institute library page under a sub tab under practice areas and under a further sub tab that's going to be the family law practice discussion area. That library is open only to JAMS neutrals. So you'd have to be a neutral. You'd have to know that this program existed, and you'd have to go several sub tabs down to find it. So I think that we're pretty secure. Finally, if you say something that you later decide you want edited out of the tape before, you know, once this conversation is done today, you can send me an email and say, delete that dirty joke I told, or, you know, that curse word, or whatever you want. We could, you know, we have that ability. So please speak freely, knowing that whatever you say today, if you have some, you know, momentary feeling of regret, that we can easily edit it out. And with that, I'll do my best Ed McMahon impression. And by the way, one little fact that you probably don't really need to know, but Ed McMahon is one of the most famous people who were born in my hometown. So with that, let's see. Nancy, do we have you? Is this you here, Nancy? Do we have you on the phone? I just unmuted 415. No, that's a 415 number. Still looking for Nancy Stock. Let's see, second page. Here we go. Nancy, there, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Rich.
All right, terrific. So I'm going to put myself on mute and sit back and listen. All right.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and good morning, everyone. I hope you can hear me. We don't have any video or visual at the moment. It actually went dark on us, but you should not be disappointed because our entire visual this morning is just a camera on me, and that can be kind of a little static and boring. I want to welcome everybody to our first family practice workshop. And this was the brainchild of a few neutrals that are finding that this is a growing and amazing opportunity for neutrals at JAMS. And we felt that this was the right time to get together in a private setting, just our neutrals, and discuss a couple things. First, how can we act to build our business? And secondly, how can we build our skills and cultivate and keep our skills up in this amazing area? First of all, let me just underscore what the opportunity is out there. I'm a what you'd call a part-time family law neutral. I was never a certified specialist. I was not a member of the American Academy or any of that. Like most judges, I came to the table and learned it on the job. And there's a little bit of truth to that in private neutral work as well. We need to rely upon each other and to try to help build our skills together. There is an incredible market right now for skilled neutrals in the field of family law. If you talk to any of your colleagues at the public courthouse, you will learn, especially from the attorneys, that conditions at the courthouse in family law are rather dire, particularly for those clients that need immediate, consecutive, full attention of a judge, and they kind of need it now. Many attorneys are calling JAMS literally from the hallways of the courthouse, trying to seek access to a neutral to find out when they can set their case, because their clients, their experts, their witnesses, and their team are all standing around running a meter in the hallway because the judge has had to put the case over to handle an emergency ex parte matter or some other kind of calendar assignment. First of all, let me just underscore that, at least in my experience, there are at least six types of assignments that are available to somebody who is ready and willing to become conversant in the area of family law. First of all, this is one of the only assignments as neutrals where we will serve as real judges. We take an oath, we sign a consent, and we are appointed by the Superior Court to sit as a judge in a case that's fully docketed at the courthouse. But that's not all. There are six ways we can serve, at least in my experience, and maybe there are more. Family law cases need discovery referees. They are sophisticated, they involve large financial and complex issues, and you can serve exclusively in that capacity. You can serve as the judge for all purposes, where the case literally leaves the courthouse and comes into the fold. You can serve as a trial judge on limited issues or specific types of matters that have been bifurcated, such as date of separation. We also serve as special masters, where we can be appointed on a long-term basis in a complex case to handle only certain types of matters, such as a child support issue or maybe a long-term special needs child custody issue. Finally, we can also serve as settlement officers, or mediators. Our clients like to call them voluntary settlement conferences, and we'll talk perhaps today about what that involves. And the sixth way we serve, which is a little unusual, many of us are arbitrators, and many retainer agreements in family law retentions have arbitration clauses. When a family law firm is sued for malpractice or attempts to collect on a bill, and there's a countersuit for malpractice, often that firm will want to have somebody conversant in family law who understands the law and the practice to serve as their arbitrator. So there are many opportunities here for family law services. Let me, if I could ask Rich to just unmute the lines and ask if there are any other ways that anybody up and down the state are serving, or any other opportunities that anybody's seeing. We have other competitors out there. Some are building stables of well-qualified family law neutrals. And in other parts of our state, quite frankly, JAMS is the big dog and there isn't a lot of competition. But Rich, perhaps you could unmute and parties could just tell us if there's any other opportunities that they're experiencing right now.
All right, so with great trepidation, I am going to unmute all, and if it turns into a slugfest for a time, then we can unmute one at a time. But here we go. Everybody's unmuted.
Good morning, everyone.
Who let the dogs out?
Okay, I think I heard Linda Miller. I heard Linda Miller say hello.
You did.
Okay, well, why don't we mute back up and we'll move to the next area. I wanted to spend a little time this morning talking about some of the resources that are available
Nancy, I'm going to have to mute everybody and then unmute you. So just a second. Here we go.
Oh.
Unmuting. Let's see. Eric, you muted the system. You muted.
So, folks, this is Nancy Stock back again. Let me ask if people could individually mute your phones, just so if we open the lines up again, we won't hear anybody who doesn't want to talk. Just if you could keep your line on permanent mute. I wanted to address a couple of resources that you might be thinking about. In a moment, we're going to hear from Renee Spurzel, our JAMS practice development manager. And I wanted to share with you a couple things. First of all, JAMS does sponsor specific activities with respect to the Association of Certified Family Law Specialists, who put on excellent training, quarterly night evening programs, multiple hours in duration, as well as other activities where we can serve as panelists. JAMS frequently will sponsor these types of events, and it gives us an opportunity to serve as panelists and attend those events with people who are definitely interested in our services. Also, the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers holds an annual educational event, high quality. It's always over Martin Luther King weekend, and they have other events around the calendar, and JAMS has stepped up to the plate to sponsor those events as well. And this does provide opportunities for our neutrals to participate in those activities. Again, this is a target-rich environment. The other resource I wanted to leave you with this morning is I think every neutral serving full-time in a family law practice or doing any kind of mediation or trials needs to have the appropriate software applications and the access through Westlaw to the TRG materials. We already have that. You should check and make sure that you have access to all those things. With respect to the child support software programs, I learned when I first came aboard at JAMS that you do not have to pay for the so-called DisoMaster type software because ex-spouse offers it for free to any judicial officer, active or retired. So if anybody's paying for that, you should stop paying and go to ex-spouse to get your free software. At this time, I'm going to turn it over to Renee, and have her discuss with you some of the ways in which we can gain some traction with respect to practice development. And she and her team have started to really pay attention to family law, and she has some questions that she'd like to put out there in terms of what you need to enhance your practice. So again, if people who are not talking would just mute your phones out of the gate, I'm going to ask Rich to go ahead and introduce Renee into the call.
All right, so I'm going to unmute everybody again. So you please mute yourselves. All right, so everybody's unmuted, but I'm hearing a lot of background noise.
That's probably from me, Rich. This is Renee.
All right, Renee.
I am at an airport, so you guys are going to get background noise. Sorry about that.
I know you wanted to do a roll call, and so let me help you with that. I see the folks I can see for sure, I'm just going to name. So I see Steve Selmayr. Hello, Steve. I see Linda Miller. I see Tom's iPad. Who is Tom's iPad belong to? Which Tom is Tom's iPad? Well, Tom's iPad is not talking to us. Silicon Valley Conference Room 2. Who's in the Silicon Valley Conference Room?
Reese Pishon.
Great. Nice to see. Well, nice to hear from you, Reese. So Glenn Reiser out there. Glenn, hello. D. Claypool. So I see McAdams. So Richard, Lynn O'Malley Taylor, S-C-L-I-S-H-A-M, and that is who? Somebody who's self-muted, I guess. Jeannie Lowe, Stacy Monaco, and then we have some phone numbers. We have a 949 number. Can somebody unmute and tell us who that belongs to?
This is Sheila.
Oh, hi, Sheila. I've got 415-774-2639. Nope, somebody not going to tell us who they are, but that's fine.
That's the San Francisco office. That's someone in San Francisco.
Okay, great. And then I have you at your number, Renee. And then let's see, who else have we not? Franz Miller. Is there anybody I haven't identified? All right, well, there's our roll call. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Renee.
Thank you, Rich, and thank you, Judge Stock. So I think that I wanted to just ask everyone some questions that will sort of lead us to developing our plans more in this practice area. I think a lot of the things that Judge Stock is talking about are things that she's seen in Southern California, and we're going to consider what is happening in Northern California and whether or not we need to make this a statewide effort or if it's two different regional efforts. And so feel free to answer me right now or send me an email with the answer to your questions. And I also wanted to mention that Stacy Monaco from the practice development team is on the call right now, as well as Danielle Claypool. And you can share your ideas with either of them as well. So the first question is, aside from what Judge Stock already said, are there other family law bar and legal organizations that we should consider sponsoring and or attending?
I can certainly pipe in on that. It's Steve Selmayr speaking. I think AFCC is an organization whose conferences are really, really useful, great networking opportunities. I definitely think we ought to have a presence there. And secondly, IACP, the International Academy of Collaborative Practitioners, I think they should know about us as well. And they also put on a great conference every year.
Thank you, Steve. Anyone else? Okay. as we're, you know, putting our face out there as to, you know, why GEMS is a good option for this, we always like to hear from all of you about what the lawyers are saying to you about what the benefits are of using GEMS and GEMS neutrals for family law ADR. Okay, please send me an email if you have an idea later. And then the last question, Renee,
this is Judge Stock. I can say that among the benefits are the concierge services and the sense of personal privacy and personal security that our facilities offer. The dignity associated with our facilities is night and day compared to the sweaty, crowded environment of the courthouse. So clearly, that is one of the most significant benefits. We hear it from the clients during mediations. We hear it immediately as people come in the door. They feel safe. They feel like there's a professional atmosphere. And quite frankly, at the end of the day, when somebody's had to make a decision, I think they're going to accept that decision with better grace if they realize it's a fully professional outfit from top to bottom. And I think that's something we really want to emphasize.
Okay, thanks. That's good.
Renee, I wouldn't mind piggybacking on what Judge Stock just said. Last October, I visited our office in Chicago, and they have a very large family law practice there. And they actually have like a separate wing of the main floor of GEMS that's just dedicated to family law mediations and arbitrations. They're mostly mediations there. They even have a separate entrances for parties who don't want to see each other. They have a play area for young kids where the kids can play and be supervised. So it's, in addition to being not the courthouse, it's also a very family-friendly environment, or at least it can be.
Okay, that's good feedback as well. Does anyone else have any thoughts on that? Thank you so much for that input, Judge Stock and Steve. So my last question sort of pertains to what I led with about, you know, whether or not this is a statewide practice, if it's more of a regional practice. What's the perception from your, from the lawyers who are bringing this work to you about the geographic reach of this area of the law? Are their practices local and or regional or more statewide? Is it based on the county where they practice and where the cases are filed? Or is there an opportunity to have a statewide practice where perhaps a neutral based in Northern California is working with clients in Southern California?
I've had experience with matters in Northern California. This is Sheila. And there are lawyers in Southern California, not regularly, but often enough to make it worthwhile, have cases in Northern California. And my experience has been that attorneys in Northern California will often look for a neutral that's not in their area because the bigger cases have gone through so many judges and neutrals that they're looking for new people that or there isn't a conflict where everybody can agree that that they want somebody new and fresh in the case. So I think that it particularly maybe in some areas where there isn't a large concentration of family law neutrals, that it's a great opportunity for GEMS.
Thank you. Thank you. Is there anyone, thank you, Justice Sunshine, is there anyone in Northern California who has a view on this question? Okay. Okay, well, this is very helpful, and I look forward to having more calls like this to talk about our plans and how your input today and other input we've gotten from you helps us to shape our plans around this practice area.
I'd like to add one other question.
Yes, please.
There's other areas we could develop beyond the six that Nancy mentioned. And I think that mock hearings, whether it's for an appellate argument, trial court setting, I've done several of those. And it's something that many lawyers, even non-family law lawyers, don't think of. And particularly in the family law field, and where the stakes can be so high in terms of what's at issue, that's an area that we can definitely exploit.
Renee, I've got a variation on that. In my family law practice at JAMS, I'm mostly working with self-represented clients. And to the extent they have representation, I try to encourage them to retain collaboratively trained lawyers. So it's a little different than the sort of paradigmatic situation where you've got AAML certified family law specialist litigators who are really driving the case and bringing the case to JAMS. I'm finding that we can also, there's a role for us to bring in pro pers who want to have professional assistance, usually mediating, but don't want to go into litigation. They don't want to be in court. So just another variation on a role we can play.
You know, I was going to perhaps close out this segment by sharing with Renee that one of the needs for neutrals in this field, as expressed to us daily by the bar, is our expertise. Oftentimes at the courthouse, new former district attorneys and other brand new judges are assigned immediately to family law, even though this is inconsistent with the Elkins Task Force recommendations and the rules of court in this area. And so frequently we are selected because they just need somebody who has a baseline knowledge of the subject matter. And this leads to another area that Renee is going to follow up on in the future, and that is what kinds of topics we may want to offer by way of presentations at JAMS or in other settings in terms of the kind of knowledge we can share. So she will be following up with us as well on what kind of sort of packaged presentation should we put out there where we can have our neutrals going around and making these presentations as we do in other topics for JAMS in our general practices. So that's something to look forward to from Renee and her team. Where can we go? What can we say? What areas do we need to step into to punctuate the fact that we are experts in the field and we offer this as one of our offerings? So any other questions or comments for Renee?
Yeah, this is Linda. I think we need to or can promote a practice area along the lines of what Sheila had to say, where someone could come in and literally give us an opening statement or a unique argument and have us throw back questions that they might get from the bench to help hone an argument or perhaps change an argument on a particular legal issue. Not really a neutral analysis, but a neutral practice. Just a suggestion.
All right.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to move to a different topic, but it has to do with our business, the business aspects of our practices. This was a great discussion about some of the different ways we can serve. And part of the purpose of this workshop is to talk a little bit about how family law is different and how it may pose challenges to us in our practices. somebody mentioned on the call, I think it might have been Glenn, that we don't just service extremely wealthy individuals. We have middle-class clients. We have clients that have run out of money and are partly pro-per or completely pro-per. One decision point that you need to make as a neutral is what your comfort level is in handling pro-per cases, either both pro-per or single pro-per. I know we have some very experienced neutrals at JAMS. Tom Murphy comes to mind, who will handle settlement conferences with unrepresented folks and then actually assist with the preparation of the settlement agreement leading to a potential template for a judgment. So I think just internally we need to figure out, do we feel competent for that? Are we up to the task? If we work with pro-pers, are we prepared to actually put something in writing? How do we feel about that? So just put that in the back of your mind. I would commend Tom Murphy to everybody in terms of talking about going from soup to nuts, because he does do that. Others of us are not as comfortable being in a position where there's no lawyer in the room to help with the written document, or we may have this hybrid model where there's a lawyer who's standing by in a collaborative capacity. So that segues to another topic, and that is, we don't just service wealthy people. We have people that are paying out of their kids' college funds and otherwise to pay for our services. And so this leads to a conversation about our billing practices, our cancellation policies, and how we hold ourselves out in this particular community. I understand I'm on camera, so I'm going to wave to everybody. let me just explain a couple things for those of us that have mixed practices and have commercial clients. I, for one, have very strict billing practices and very severe cancellation policies, and I don't really flex too much on that for obvious reasons. When it comes to my family law clients, however, I'm very flexible, particularly on my cancellation policies. I will virtually always allow a case to go over to another date, and I will never charge them lost time for the date. We'll just continue it over to the date in question. With respect to my rates, I've increased my rates this last year for family law. In Orange County, the practitioners here in Irvine, we've all kept our rates a little bit lower for the family law practice, just because it's somewhat cultural to our area. But that doesn't necessarily have to be the case, and you should work with your practice, your case manager, in determining what you should charge. There are also issues of hourly rates versus full-day rate. In Irvine, the culture seems to be that family law is charged on an hourly basis. We don't hit people for a full day necessarily if we don't go the full day, but that's on a very individualized basis. My advice in this area would be to engage in the practices you feel you're comfortable with, to encourage repeat business, to have people feel like they were treated fairly, but not to be serving pro-per yourself or otherwise giving away your services for free. So I wanted to ask Rich if he could open up the lines and have some of our experienced neutrals just share any tips you have about cultivating this practice with respect to billing rates, full day versus half, cancellation policies, billing courtesies, scheduling courtesies, anything you might do in this field that perhaps you are not necessarily doing in your commercial practice.
Well, as a testament to how well behaved our crowd is, they have been unmuted this whole time, and so they've just been self-muting. So the lines are open to anybody who wants to unmute and talk.
Good morning, Rich. This is Mindy Johnson. How are you?
I'm well, Mindy. So I understand it's very early where you are. You want to
disclose? I'm in Hilo, Hawaii. It's 6:30 in the morning, but here I am. the one thing I would say based on what I did hear Nancy say is, particularly for family law cases, once fees have been paid, I don't usually, because I don't want to undercut jams, I don't let them, you know, refund any money ever, but I always give credit. So if they rebook something, they continue it, or they cancel it, and then they rebook later, which happens in family law a lot, I always give them credit for those hours later, and JAMS has always accommodated me with that. I think that's a good practice builder, as Nancy said, building the repeat customers so that they know that they're going to be treated fairly. So I agree with her on that.
And this is Sheila. My experience is the same as Nancy's.
And I agree with Mindy. I don't forfeit the fee. I charge the fee and then we credit them because if they don't come back, if they settle, that would not be an appropriate practice at JAMS. So thank you for that clarification.
I also bill my family law cases by the hour at a rate that is lower than what I would charge for commercial cases. And sometimes I'll do a half day rate, sometimes I'll do a full day if that's what's needed. But by and large, I find most propers want to come in for, maybe they can do 3 hours, something like that.
One other thought, particularly, I don't get a lot of propers, but I do get some, or some with attorneys standing by. And sometimes, because they just don't quite know how to handle it, I do a series of 3 or 4 hour ones. It's easier for them sometimes to bite them off in pieces. So I'll say, you know, we'll do 4 hours one day. We'll start talking about all the property you have, et cetera. But then be ready to schedule in a few weeks another 3 or 4 hours. That seems to work pretty well with them because that's how much they can cope with at a time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do the same thing. It's always a series of 3 hour meetings. And sometimes I'll do a day long at the end when the lawyers need to be there for some reason and we just want to wrap it up. But that's the exception, not the rule.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for your thoughts about that. Let me turn to another topic, and that has to do with some of the challenges we have serving as real trial judges outside of the courthouse setting. Let me remind everybody that we are appointed, and we actually take an oath when we sign the forms, and we're appointed by the presiding judge or the supervising judge of family law. And we actually sign an oath and an acknowledgement that we are governed by Canon 6 of the Judicial Canons of Ethics. And I don't know about you, but when I became a private neutral, I breathed a sigh of relief that I had my First Amendment rights intact, that I could network and go places I never went before, and that I could actually exercise a little bit more freedom in my personal life. And yet every time I sign a family law consent to be appointed as a judge, I'm signing up for Canon 6 again. I think that this might be a worthy topic for a separate workshop in terms of exactly what that means. Are we fish? Are we fowl? Are we Canon 6 only for our family law cases? How do we conduct ourselves so as to stay within the confines of the canon, which quite frankly, I found to be very restrictive as a judicial officer. There's a couple of areas that I think are kind of obvious. One is, this is a marvelous opportunity for both us and the public to have qualified judges serving in this capacity for family law cases. I believe that we could be at risk politically of potentially losing this privilege if it should ever come to pass that somebody believed that people were getting private trials or private services that were completely blacked out at the courthouse. this could happen in only one way, and that would be because we have not properly policed the filing of court documents in the court file during the time that we're on the case. This is a problem. I know colleagues at the courthouse have told me over the years that they will bring a case in, and it may have been in a private judging arena before, not with JAMS, but another provider, and the case is missing critical documents that are associated with its history. This is very dangerous and very bad for a lot of reasons, but I think it could cost us the privilege if this became a habit. I wanted to share with you a couple of things that I do to try to prevent this from happening. At the bottom of every single order, notice of hearing, a notice of ruling, order after hearing, or even judgment, I have a standard order that states that counsel for petitioner or respondent shall promptly serve this order or file it with the court and serve a proof of service on JAMS that a conformed file stamp copy has been filed. Some of you may want to revisit your practices in terms of what you do with judgments. I now personally have JAMS file two documents, any judgment and my notice of completion. I do not trust counsel and their busy staffs to necessarily get that in there. I actually had a notice of completion that I signed and served, and the parties held it for 4 months because they kind of wanted me to stay around on the case. That's potentially a violation of the appointment order. Many courts are now limiting your appointment order, or they're saying that within 60 days of termination of your work, you need to file the notice of completion. So those are two documents that I personally see my way into the courthouse. At Irvine, everything else goes through the attorneys. Our people just don't file all of the high traffic volume material directly to the courthouse ourselves. Someday, we will be able to have full access statewide to the electronic filing systems without charge as if we are parties, but we do not have that at this time everywhere. And I wanted to just throw that out as a red flag. It's one of the first ways we could lose the privilege. Let me also say that one of the big challenges that's obvious is we do not have clerks. We don't have clerks' minutes. We become the clerks. And in my case, that's not a good thing because I'm writing things on a yellow pad and wearing three or four different hats during the case. We keep our own exhibit lists. We have all these other things that we have to do. In large commercial cases where I have multiple law firms at the table, I've actually assigned, with the consent of counsel, one of the lawyers or paralegals to keep the accurate exhibit list and to otherwise keep some of the records of the activity in the case. Short of that, it's up to us to do it. What I'm doing is when I do an order after hearing or a notice of ruling, I'm including a little preamble at the front of everything we did, who was present, was a court reporter there. I'm highlighting all of our case management updates. I'm just throwing that in there in addition to the rulings I made. So there's some breadcrumbs out there as to what we did that might mimic clerk's minutes. There's a couple of tools that I want to put on the table that I'm very excited about. First, we have a vendor relationship with Case Anywhere. And for cases that can afford it, I would encourage each of you, and I know Glenn is a big fan out there as well, to use Case Anywhere to have service, docketing, message board, everything goes into that system, and you have instant access to your calendar capability for all of your documents in a complex case. I would get folks on that at all costs if they can afford it. If they can't afford it, I have very good news. Starting in May of this year, we are scheduled to launch a full dashboard capability at JAMS that will mimic the functionality of Case Anywhere. And we will have the ability, as this thing grows, to have our files in one place and have instantaneous records of everything we do in the case. we may no longer have to search our email inboxes to figure out what in the heck is going on. We will not have to look at our email inboxes to figure out what the case managers have been saying or what the status of the case is. And from a client-facing point of view, the features are going to be very rich. But my takeaway on this one is try to get the folks into some kind of docketing system. It costs $40 a month. It costs like $5 to upload a document. It will be a lifesaver, and it will help you manage a case where you have no clerk, you sometimes have no court reporter, and your lawyers are a little distracted and don't keep track of some of these things. So that is, those are some of the tips on just the navigation of being a trial judge in a family law case. I'd like to throw it back open if people have other practice tips they'd like to share with the group.
I just wanted to comment. I was really pleased, Nancy, that you brought up the fact that JAMS is producing an internal version of Case Anywhere. And one thing that, just to be clear, that's going to be at no cost to the clients. And so while Case Anywhere currently is quite affordable, some people still bristle against anything that costs anything. And so it will be a free service. So looking forward to that among the various tech improvements. So thank you to William Zahner and his team who are not hearing this, but well, it's a very important exercise that we're doing.
So I have a question, Nancy. Apropos of getting a judgment filed and having ruled and directed a party to get the judgment done and they don't do it. And so the case is open and I can't get a judgment done. What authority as the judge for all purposes do I have to get that finished? If you could comment.
Well, first of all, you've already ordered one party to prepare the judgment.
I have.
So if that does not happen, perhaps you ordered the other party to prepare the judgment. In terms of keeping track of whether they did it, if you're on Case Anywhere, you have dashboard control. If you're not, I just have my case manager tickler back a suitable interval of time where I go back and I check to see whether a particular function has been completed. And if it has not been completed, and gap here, you could even put a notice into the court file as to why you're not filing your notice of completion.
Okay.
Any other ideas from anybody else?
What a shy group. I had no idea y'all were so reticent.
Well, you know, I don't have any ideas on that one, but I do know that many of the attorneys either don't understand or forget or whatever that they have to be filing all their documents with the court first and we get the copies, not vice versa. I have to have a scheduling order that includes that. Court gets the original, not me. And some of them were not filing then my orders. I'd have an order after an RFO. They didn't file them with the court, and then they had enforceability issues. Once I learned that, I do a minute order every single day of any family law case on which I sit pro tem. And I have some probate cases, which is the same thing. It's time consuming, but I just create a record every day as a clerk would do a minute order, and I send it to them. I can't file it with the court, but I send it with them so that they at least have that. And I'll look forward to having the central free repository in May.
That's a good tip. And I wanted to point out, I think the availability of a docketing system like Case Anywhere or the new dashboard we're gonna get, that's causing some confusion. I just realized people think when they upload their document to us that that's some kind of a filing. And we've created our own confusion. Their staff doesn't realize that isn't a filing. So Mindy raises a good point. We need to, once we get people onto these systems, we have to explain to them that this is just a tool. It's not the courthouse. Let me point out also there are some other reasons why people use us and some techniques you might want to use. And I know we have some very high-tech people on the call, including Glenn. I'm going to call him out again. I'm asking counsel to submit all of their trial exhibits on flash drives and only give me a key exhibit binder, period. They can bring a set of binders in for the witnesses, but I'm working completely electronically with the exception of the key exhibits. I'm also taking transcripts on a flash drive, as the transcripts are prepared each day in a long cause matter. They either upload them to me, we have a library, or they just email them, and I'm keeping all the transcripts on a flash drive. So you literally get up at the end of a case, and these firms are having their hand trucks and their facilities people come in and haul away 50 boxes, and you're walking off with your laptop and two flash drives and a binder. The use of electronic docketing will help us even more to do that, because not only will you have all of these things available, you'll have the whole case electronically like you do at the courthouse. You can look in and you can see what's going on. So you can tell I'm very excited about using these tools, and I really believe it will set us apart as a provider from many other providers. I also would encourage each of us to cross-train each other. Walk into a hearing room where somebody's all electronic and see how that works and develop your own comfort level. You may decide that it just doesn't work. For example, here in Irvine, we have a state-of-the-art facility that was built to current standards. And we realized that our evidence presentation screens were on the wrong walls, facing the wrong way, and the witnesses couldn't see them. We had to hang a couple extra screens. We also realized that for the average person, it's almost impossible to see a written document on a screen across the room. And so for cases that are involving a lot of reading of contracts, and family law involves a lot of documents, that's not a good way to go. And you're going to have to use the old-fashioned binder, or if the case warrants the budget, you can get these screens on their tables. So even though we have the capacity to have all the bells and whistles, it may not work out in reality that we are going to be able to use all that. But I would encourage everybody to look around, talk to others of us. One of the purposes of these workshops is to share our failures and our successes and walk away with a couple of nuggets that we can. Any other comments on navigating the role of trial judge or any of the bells and whistles that you want to put on the table?
So this is Glenn, since you called me out. My own personal practice is I don't ever want to receive a notebook because it's a notebook. So everything that I receive is on flash drive. It'd be interesting if that uploaded to, when you're talking about trial exhibits and things, depending on the capabilities of the Case Anywhere system, if that could be uploaded, or that would even be easier. But between, obviously you need a hard copy for the witness, right? So those notebooks would still be required when there are live witnesses there. And then between counsel, all of my orders on these ARBs simply say that, you know, they can agree among themselves to exchange flash drives and or electronic information. But, you know, I don't try to mandate it up front because I don't want to socially engineer that much. But I do, in all my cases, encourage people to appear remotely through Zoom or otherwise, but typically Zoom, because I think it works really well. And it's pretty flawless, other than the fact that sometimes there's other people in the room cueing the witness who's appearing remotely.
So I think our takeaway on this one is we can set ourselves apart. I know that when I started migrating lawyers onto Case Anywhere in family law, it became a badge of honor. People were bragging about how they were in this rarefied air of doing these things in something that people wanted to do. So again, just from a marketing standpoint, it's a good thing. I would like to close with one final topic that has to do with our role as trial judge. And that is the circumstance where we become, we are asked to migrate into the role of mediator or settlement judge. In the Irvine market, I know that sometimes we will get appointment orders that have us already named as the settlement judge. We are appointed as a trial judge for all purposes, and they've already named us as the settlement judge. And then the parties will, you know, devote maybe a sentence or two to, okay, and it's okay if Judge Stock, we waive anything. My practice tip to you on this one is don't take the one-line waiver in the little appointment order. You want to have an extremely robust acknowledgement and waiver form in writing, where preferably you voir dire the parties on the record if a court reporter is available, or at a minimum, you have them sit down with their lawyers and read and sign. I have a sample that I've used back at the courthouse and now, and I'm going to give it to Rich to put on our site, No Pride of Authorship, but I call it the felony plea. It's got about six different parts to it, and by the time they're done with that, I think we've insulated ourselves from the concepts of conflict or anything like that. And it also explains in the waiver what happens when I serve as a mediator. Many clients, that is the parties, don't understand the intimacy, the kind of conversations, the secret going from room to room, and the very candid disclosures that occur in a mediation. And this is particularly important if you're doing it mid-trial, which is another practice point to think about. We are sometimes asked to break it down and settle a case mid-trial. You have to decide what your comfort level is on that, what kind of a case is it, who are the parties, what have you heard, and do you think you can get it settled? In other words, what are the chances you're going to have to go back and try the case? These are all personal decisions on your part. Some of you may choose not to be a settlement judge and a trial judge at the same time. But if you do, I would commend to you that you take it real seriously as far as any potential blowback. Obviously, you want to settle the case. Obviously, you're hoping you never become the trial judge. But this waiver form, we're going to put it up on the site. If anybody has any improvements or war stories that they go, you know what, we need to add a sentence here because I had the following experience, or you get any feedback from the lawyers on the form, by all means, put your version of it up there so we can all benefit. As we close out our time this morning, are there any comments about the pitfalls of serving as a settlement judge and trial judge in family law?
This is Mindy. I hate to do it, and for reasons unknown, the parties always seem to want you to do it. And I agree with Nancy. You have to sit everybody down, explain, I'm going to hear things now that you won't know I'm hearing. I'll try to unthink it when I have to try the case, but it's very difficult, and I do not know why it's so popular among the attorneys, but it surely is.
Yeah.
Well, I'll take a contrary view. I love doing it, and I'm often one who will suggest it if I'm not already, well, particularly if I start, that doesn't matter. Whether I start as a mediator or start as a judge pro tem, I think it makes a lot of sense. But I too am careful to make sure that they understand what they're doing.
Well, Rich, I'm going to throw it back to you to close us out. Again, we hope to have another workshop like this. Justice Sonnenschein will be leading the next set of topics. I think Rich did circulate some questions for you a couple months ago about what you want to talk about. But obviously, the benefit of these workshops is the expertise of everybody on the call. So if there's anything we want to, any breaking news we need to discuss, let him know. And hopefully we can keep this going.
I'd really appreciate hearing anything. any topics that you'd like to discuss at our on our next call.
Absolutely. So I'm going to put an invitation out to everybody. Again, a reminder that this exists for you all, and I want you to take ownership of it. So that means that any comments that you have about the format, how it worked, if you want some instructions on how to be a more effective Zoomer, please let me know. If you have thoughts about topics or dates or times or anything at all, forward them. If you have ideas for what you'd like to see in our practice, one thought that occurred to me in an earlier part of the conversation was people suggested, you know, maybe going out and training some folks about kind of or educating some folks about what we do. One possibility is that we could put together a team and maybe create a single PowerPoint presentation with some teaching notes so that we could all be out there kind of teaching off the same clip. But there's any number of possibilities, and they're all going to be driven by you, because I can help be the bike mechanic, but you're going to be the one steering the wheel and turning the So.
Very good. Well, thank you, Rich. We'll go ahead and let everybody get to court or otherwise, quote unquote. And again, thank you all for your participation.